ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Anthony Burke. You might know me from Grand Designs Australia, but on my podcast, By Design, I get to go deeper. I dig into the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, the systems, and the objects shaping your life. From prefab housing to cruise ships to the welcome mat at your front door, someone designed them. And the stories behind those choices are fascinating. Come and find By Design on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Certainly, as early as the late Stone Age, we were drinking wine. We made it, traded it, drank it, and honoured the gods with it. The history of wine, in its way, is the history of civilization. Later in the show, 8,000 years in a glass. But first, Bernard Keane is a bit embarrassed about outing himself as an optimist in his new book, Seize the Moment. Excoriating politicians for their failures is his trade as the Canberra voice of Crikey. Disaster faces Australia at every turn in his reporting. But in his book, out now, Keane argues that Australia's success so far this century, compared with the United States and other countries like the United Kingdom, surely gives us cause for optimism that Australia can make the right calls and prosper in the 21st century. Bernard Keane joins me here in the studio to defend his unexpectedly cheerful outlook and his faith in this country's capacity to respond cleverly and effectively, his words, to the challenges scattered in our path. Bernard, welcome.
Good to be with you.
You've come a long way since publishing your second book with the title The Mess We're In, How Our Politics Went to Hell and Dragged Us With It. That was 8 years ago. What's happened to us, to you, and to them in that time?
Well, things can be terrible, but one can remain optimistic or at least avoid succumbing to pessimism. Now, I get very angry about public policy and the failures of our political leaders and our corporate leaders and leaders generally, but I think I do so because there is an optimistic streak in me that says we can do this better. The world is improvable and you can improve it with good public policy. And we've actually done this before. We've made some good calls in the past. So, yeah, you can be excoriating, as I enjoy being, toward our key decision makers.
There is real pleasure in your prose, yes. Yeah,
absolutely. But it comes from a belief that, hey, we can actually be better than this. And we know we can be better than this because we've been better than this before. And that's I think, the basis of the optimism. And look around the world at the moment at all awful things going on and our own country and terrible things going on. And I think if you say, oh, well, that's it, you know, I give up, we can't actually fix things, then that's a good guarantee that things are going to get worse. The only guarantee that things are actually going to improve is if we actually work to make them better. All of us, voters, in our roles as voters, as consumers, and when we're leaders, as political leaders or corporate leaders or community leaders.
Interesting reflection you make in the book, that you are at heart a historian. Is that a source of optimism as well? A source at least of confidence that it's worth keeping going?
Absolutely. I mean, without sort of becoming too much sort of Steven Pinker, I think you've only got to study a little bit of history to realise that things can improve. They don't always go in a straight line. They don't always improve in a straight line. We go backwards. In the 20th century, we went backwards in absolutely catastrophic ways. But I think to have a good understanding of history is to realise that when people actually work at it, then things can improve. Our health improves, our longevity, our treatment of each other improves, our capacity to build good institutions that actually deliver for a lot of people, if not everyone, but a lot of people rather than just a few. History shows that we can actually achieve these things. And again, it comes back to the lesson, we've done it before. we can keep doing it. We haven't suffered some sort of irreparable loss of talent in the ability to make good decisions, but we do need to find a way to have a better process for making those decisions.
Fundamental to your optimism is the argument that we have escaped the Trump moment. Unlike other countries, United States in particular, UK, we have escaped the Trump moment. What is the Trump moment?
The Trump moment is that point at which, and it's not so much about the individual in the White House as what he represents, which is the moment in which the resentment and the anger and the disillusionment about free market economics and about a more equal society erupts into not just discontent, not just marginal political parties, but erupts into the mainstream to demolish institutions, to threaten democracy, to shake society. And that's what's happened in the United States, where the Republican Party has been transformed into a vehicle for kleptocracy and autocracy. You know, even people we once looked down upon as exemplars of the Republican Party in the United States now look relatively benign in retrospect. They've been purged and replaced with MAGA, which is, you know, something very, very dark. We haven't gone down that particular route.
Now, why not?
Well, we haven't gone down yet. I wrote most of this book before the current surge in the polling of One Nation, but even when I was writing it, I was noting we've avoided it so far, and you know, we may yet go down that particular way. But I think we've avoided it so far, and I think the nation did face a kind of Trump moment in the 2025 election, when the Peter Dutton-led coalition really embraced Trump, the restored Trump, the returned king, in the aftermath of his re-election and an inauguration, and then badly came a cropper in May last year. Why did that happen? I think, well, a number of reasons. One is pure timing. Like Canada, we got to see what it's like when you actually put a Trump into power. And we had a pretty visceral demonstration of that with what happened with Vladimir Zelensky in the White House, what happened with tariffs and their impact on Australia. So,
God, it looks mild looking back, doesn't it?
Well, that was only the introduction. We hadn't really got into the plot yet. That was early days.
But it was visible to Australians.
Very visible, and all too visible from the point of view of the coalition. And I think the penny simply didn't drop with them that they were embracing something that a lot of Australians were looking askance at. But longer term, I think we have made a number of good decisions economically in the last 40 years that have spared us some of the immense problems that have cropped up in the United States. Our version of free market economics was implemented by a government that was very keen to preserve social protections and to look after workers, rather than as it was implemented in the US or the UK or New Zealand, for that matter. And that, I think, provided some sort of padding around the implementation of free market economics here.
Why did we provide the padding and those societies not?
Well, Reagan and Thatcher and their respective parties, driven by ideology, pursued a much more hardline implementation of free market economics than we did. And in the United States case, there's far less tradition of looking after workers anyway. And there's certainly no tradition of you know, for example, providing anything such as Medicare, which was,
that's communist.
Absolutely, socialized medicine, which was fundamental to the Hawke-Keating reform agenda in terms of a trade-off with the union movement. And New Zealand's always been a fascinating case study because their Labor implemented the reforms, first round of free market reforms over there, but it pursued a much more hardline version of it than we did. They were then replaced by an even more hardline Nationals government. In Australia, I think our political traditions and the fact that our free market reforms were pursued by Labor and by two individuals who were unique in their capacity to implement policy effectively, that's Bob Hawke and Paul Keating, we ended up with a different economic outcome. The other key element, I think, is we have a very different economic relationship with China than the United States does.
Now, just before we get on to that, let's just pause for a second here and look at the way in which the new economics was imposed. My memory of that time is that nearly every argument for caution was answered by the claim that everyone would be more prosperous as a result of these reforms, that the societies would bloom because of these reforms. But it didn't turn out that way for the United States. It didn't turn out that way for the United Kingdom. And to what extent did Australia avoid the sort of gross exploitation by corporations of these new freedoms? Did we manage to sidestep that?
We sidestepped it partly, but we did see something similar here, which is those neoliberal reforms did deliver in terms of higher incomes, lower inflation, better economic growth, better standards of living. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But over time, the productivity boost faded. Economic growth dampened. Other external economic factors began intruding, such as the financial crisis. But corporations worked out how to manipulate the policy process. And the 1990s, in a way, was a learning curve for corporations as to how to influence policy in Australia. They'd always been capable of influencing policy, but I think in the Hawke Keating years, business in Australia thought, we're really not being part of the argument here. We're going to have to lift our game in terms of influencing policy. And they did very effectively. And from the mid-1990s onwards, I think we saw policy increasingly influenced by vested interests. And the result of that is that the benefits, we got the initial hit of benefits from free market economics, but then we started getting the negatives, which is concentration of markets, increasingly powerful companies exploiting their market power, both in terms of consumers and in terms of workers, and policy decisions being made based on the influence of vested interests rather than based, as a lot more of it was, if not always in the most pure way, as it was in the Hawke Keating years. And that meant that Australia did have some of those same problems that the United States and other countries had, which is the curdling of neoliberalism into a policy process dictated by oligopolies and monopolies wielding enormous power.
How much of that is the result of the collapse of the union movement? And is that reversible?
I don't think that the collapse of the union movement is reversible any more than the collapse of membership of political parties, major political parties, is reversible. The United States has always been an environment where money has talked in politics.
Never louder than now.
Never louder than now. The amount of money... The Grattan Institute did a fascinating study a few years back, which looked at who did the most attempt to influence politicians in Queensland, because Queensland is really good in that it has all this data on ministerial meetings, who donates, what they talk about, and it discovered something that kind of seems commonsensical, but was worth knowing anyway, which is that the industries that are most regulated are the ones that do the most lobbying. i.e. the ones who have the most to gain from influencing decision makers are the ones who put all their money into lobbying. And America is the ultimate expression of that, because the biggest lobbyists in the United States are the pharmaceutical companies. And they've been pharmaceutical companies which have been responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths in that country via the opioid epidemic, but which continue to influence American politics at a fundamental level. That's a demonstration of the extent to which the American polity, you know, for all that Donald Trump and his family are supreme kleptocrats, the pond was stagnant well before Donald Trump arrived. And is it any wonder that a lot of Americans responded positively when he said he wanted to drain the swamp? They were all too aware that there was indeed a swamp there.
What a fraudster.
David, this is the great tradition of members of the elite saying to the rest of us, look at what these terrible elites are doing. I'm going to purge them as your champion. Get behind me. The variations of that have been, you know, absolutely standard part of American political discourse. For the Democrats used it in racial terms in the South for so many decades up until the 1960s. And it's, it always ends with the people who think that they're going to get something better from it end up being doubted. That's how it's turned out with Donald Trump. And I would argue that's very likely how it would turn out if Pauline Hanson ever got the keys, or Barnaby Joyce got the keys to the lodge and pursued similar policies.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Bernard Keane, who is the political editor of Crikey, and has just published Seize the Moment, Australia's Real Opportunities in an Unstable World. Now, Bernard, I'm going to drag you back from, and it's my fault, from us looking at the whole world to looking at Australia. Now, let's look at some of the, I would have thought, intractable challenges facing Australia, and let us gauge your optimism that we might be able to address them. The first, our relationship with America. You argue, as God knows how many writers, analysts, historians, politicians, journalists have argued, we must reassess and rework our relationship with America. Can we?
We've done it before. Paul Keating did it before. Not in terms of pursuing any sort of a hostile relationship with the United States. In fact, Keating wanted the United States more engaged in our region and worked assiduously with Bill Clinton to try and achieve that. But what Keating also wanted to do was to build Australia's place in the region, to famously to obtain our security in the region, not from the region, and to develop relationships within what he saw as the most important economically and strategically area of the world. And so Keating, there's an excellent new book by James Curran, just come out on Keating's foreign policy. But Keating wanted to do both. He wanted to have an engaged America, but he wanted to have a more independent Australia that made its own way and recognised that its future was in Asia and actually worked toward that.
But Bernard, that was 30 years ago. What about now?
The problem is that we've gone from the party of Paul Keating to the party of Anthony Albanese and Richard Miles.
Who you argue may be the most pro-American, that Albanese may be the most pro-American prime minister we've ever had. Explain yourself, sir.
Absolutely. I think I don't think any serious objection can be raised to that in terms of our level of military engagement with the United States. It's not just AUKUS. I mean, the bulk of AUKUS hasn't happened yet. in terms of submarine construction, probably will never happen. In terms of military engagement, we have American supply dumps here, forward position for a conflict with China. We've opened up, and this was an initiative of the coalition government, but the Albanese government has embraced it and given more funding. We've got B-52 bombers now based in RAAF Tyndall, up in the Top End. We've got what will become a US submarine base, regardless of what Pat Conroy might say. We've got a US nuclear submarine facility over in Perth. That's in addition to our existing array of American facilities, such as the intelligence facilities and the communication facilities. The bulk of those have occurred on the watch of the Albanese government. Our integration into the US military machine has accelerated since 2022 to a degree that no former Australian government has ever come close to achieving, except the Curtin government in World War II.
And so your source of optimism that we might be able to rework this relationship is what?
If there's a council of despair, it's probably got the loudest voice in this chapter. But I come back to the fact that that we have everything I've tried to do in this book is about things that either we've done before or are being done somewhere in Australia right at the moment. I'm not interested really in utopian proposals, and I think given the fact that we have had a government previously that has managed to chew gum and walk at the same time strategically, seen its future in Asia and yet, you know, kept in the good books of the United States and worked with them on issues like multilateralism. And, it was a very different world back then, particularly with regard to trade. But these things have been done before. What will it take to get them done again? Well, I think we do need a refurbishment of the Labor Party, but there are voices within the coalition who talk eminent good sense when it comes to our relations with the United States. Andrew Hastie, I've been very impressed with Andrew Hastie's willingness to say things about the United States that I'm not sure too many other people in the Liberal Party would have dared to say. And of course, he can say it because he served in Afghanistan He's been in combat, so he knows very much the direct price of American militarism. So, you know, if there's someone who could actually take us into it's less about being more independent than I think being more realistic. If there's someone who could take us into a more realistic strategic stance that recognises exactly what the United States has become, it's someone like Hastie who is, you know, can speak his mind and doesn't have to worry about the feral reaction from the likes of News Corp to what might be portrayed, if they came from a Labor minister, as anti-Americanism.
All right, Bernard. And I think what you're saying is we've done it in the past and we could do it again in the future. Let me put another intractable to you, the capacity to tax ourselves properly. What Yes. gives you any cause for optimism that this might be resolved?
Having watched Labor struggle through its most recent and fairly modest set of tax reforms, it's kind of confirmed the lessons I conclude that chapter with, which is if you're going to reform tax in Australia, you've got to do it from government. You can't do what Bill Shorten did or John Hewson did, which is promise these, you know, grand new tax reforms from opposition and then just have them demolished by a rampaging government.
And ladies and gentlemen, he's about to say something incredibly mischievous. Go on.
and you've got to cheat a little. You know, there are good ways of doing policy where you go to the community, you say, here's the problem. Here are what we think are some solutions. You know, what do you think? Or there's a way of going, well, here's what we're doing. It's a fait accompli and charging ahead and trying to get the debate over and done with as quickly as possible and throwing a lot of money at advertising to help you with. Everyone remembers those Howard era GST ads featuring all those chains.
Oh, I'd forgotten them. Unchained, yes, breaking your heart. Chains.
Tens of millions of dollars were spent on those. To considerable criticism of the Howard government, but looking back, just to be realistic, if you're a government and you want to get serious tax reform through, I think you've got to cook the books a little bit. You've got to dodge the traditional policy process. You've got to go out and advertise, and you've got to recognise that there is very little good faith tax debate in Australia. The majority of our tax debate is by vested interest pushing for pushing what they want. And it's, as I talk about in the book and others have spoken about as well, you know, the Financial Review is a perfect example of this, a constant clamour for tax reform. But whenever anyone puts forward actual tax reform in the national interest, it's decried as a savage attack on wealthy older asset owners.
And nurses and teachers who are seeking to make themselves rich. So your proposition is you lie your way through the elections, you ambush the public with the changes, and you spend heavily on advertising to make them sell. Okay, no, that's
what the record shows.
That's something
works.
To keep in mind.
That's what the record shows.
Do you reckon at the moment, actually, that the Albanese government is suffering from the tax changes that it's just put through?
I think it's created some inclement weather for it. I don't think that is going to be a significant factor in the election in 2028. I think its role in the current plateauing of, shall we say, of house prices, or very, very mild diminution in house prices, is fairly low. I think a lot more of that is to do with...
Are you not reading News Limited newspapers? It's a catastrophe.
Oh, yeah, I know.
The collapse of house prices, Bernard, is a crisis, a catastrophe.
Yeah, and some of those same papers, of course, love to tell us about the housing crisis and young people not being able to get into houses. But they don't have to be consistent.
No.
Governments do.
No.
But I don't think in a couple of years' time, those tax changes or the current situation with property prices is going to be a big drag on Labor's vote. What I think will be a big drag is if inflation persists, if there isn't a sign that inflation, the interest rates are going to start coming down and people don't start to feel a bit more financial and economic security, because I think that's what's driving the shift to One Nation beyond, you know, the traditional One Nation vote of aggrieved older men. It's the sense, it's the lack of certainty, it's the sense of precarity in people's finances. They want, they perceive that their their economic and financial needs, or their situation has deteriorated, and they're not seeing anything coming from the major parties that's actually going to change that. Now, that's, you know, the extent to which that changes will depend heavily on the government's policies and on the overall level of inflation over the next 2 years.
We could have done half an hour on tax. We could do half an hour on renewables. I just want to challenge you here. You say, and you're not alone in this, that a world of renewables is something Australia could just become incredibly prosperous from. We could do so well by going to renewables. But, Bernard, what signs are there that our politics will not remain as it is at the moment, which is just absolutely divided between the renewables and oil and coal and gas?
The sheer cost of renewables versus fossil fuels and alternates, particularly nuclear power, I think is going to continue to be a key driver of investment.
You think that the logic of that will change Australian politics?
Well, that's what drives investment decisions ultimately. Now, it's quite possible a government could get in that simply scraps all funding of any kind or all support of any kind for renewables, and that will mean prices will go up. I mean, we are starting to see the first impacts of lower prices from renewables because they cost far less to build and they run extremely cheaply because they don't need any fuel. So the economic case, I think, is going to continue to drive that. I think the problem that we've got around renewables, apart from the fact that we've got to build so much more...
Poles and wires,
so much more transmission infrastructure to get that stuff out there is... We have got a big problem with the demand side of the equation. If we, all this talk about us becoming a renewable energy superpower, and it's not just a fancy slogan from Labor that was abandoned in the government's first term. It's not just the line from people like Ross Garnaut and Rod Sims, but it's not going to happen if we don't actually have demand for the products that renewable energy can enable us to embrace. So there's all this talk about the fact that, yeah, there could be a big future in green iron and green steel. Big export dollars are available there, hundreds of billions of dollars. Problem is, China is investing massively in exactly the same market and it already dominates global steel production. But secondly, no one's actually buying the stuff here in Australia, which is one of the reasons why Andrew Forrest gave up on building all these green hydrogen plants is because, you can get a discount from the government, you can get a subsidy from the government to build the things, but you need someone to buy the stuff. And unless you have a carbon price that's going to incentivize people to say, yeah, well, maybe I should start thinking about steel production using electrification and using hydrogen rather than usual processes, there's no point in building these things. You can't subsidise your way to a future made in Australia. You've got to have actual demand coming from the market.
Yeah. Okay, now look, we've only got a couple of minutes left and I would like to continue this conversation for an hour, but in the couple of minutes, I want to go back to something fundamental you say about the Trump moment. And that is the role of the aggrieved white man in the Trump moment. And I wonder whether part of our being able to stay clear is that aggrieved, that white men are not remotely as aggrieved in Australia as they are in America.
I think that's absolutely true. There are certainly aggrieved white men in Australia.
Indeed, noisy and continuously, but...
Quite possibly where... some of them as well. But if you look at the United States, the men of a certain class faced an absolute onslaught over the last 20 years. So they worked in manufacturing. They may well have lost their jobs because of the impact of China on American manufacturing. They faced a massive undermining of their social privilege anti-discrimination and the shift to equal opportunity.
And there were all of those black Americans waiting to take up the opportunities that they saw themselves being exiled from.
Exactly. Even though black Americans actually suffer for far worse outcomes in terms of economics and health than white men do. And they also face an opioid epidemic, which killed, as I said earlier, hundreds of thousands of people. So you can say, well, you know, why are you complaining about, you know, loss of social privilege? I mean, that's a case of, you know, for, to any privileged person, equality feels like oppression. But nonetheless, for a lot of people, a lot of men in America, the last 20, 30 years have seemed an absolute ordeal.
But and not so much here.
Not so much here. We don't have the deaths of, we haven't had the deaths of despair epidemic here in any way, shape or form. The UK had a lot of deaths of despair later, much later in the 2010s than the US did. That's when their minor epidemic began there. We've never had anything like that. Our manufacturing sector shrunk as a result of the Hawke-Keating reforms. It's stabilised at around 800,000, 900,000 jobs now for the last decade. China has not had the negative economic impact in Australia that it had in the United States. It is, in fact, quite the opposite. China has been a just relentless boom for Australia. It is its appetite for our exports, the massive trade surplus that we run with China, has propped up our growth, propped up our employment, and propped up our government's budgets as well. And that, you know, very different economic experience, I think, is one of the reasons why, you know, Australia came into the early 21st century in reasonably good nick. We got through the financial crisis pretty well. There was basically a depression in Europe and the UK and the US after the financial crisis.
But not here.
We had a mining investment boom that sent our dollar over parity with the US. So we haven't had the kinds of economic crises that the United States and the United Kingdom have suffered. And I think that's, you know, coming back to what we talked about earlier, that I think has played a big role in ensuring that no, there isn't that level of resentment out there. There isn't this perception that the system just works for the benefit of a few rather than for everyone, that the system is, you know, biased against middle-aged white men who, you know, used to be the kind of people who, you know, worked at the local factory.
Yeah.
Or, you know, worked in construction and who now are struggling for a job.
Which gets us back to your core argument. So, Bernard, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Dave.
I've been talking to Bernard Keane, political editor of Crikey and author of, just published by Allen & Unwin, Seize the Moment, Australia's Real Opportunities in the Unstable World. Coming up, how wine made the civilised world. It's simple, really. Wine is alcohol made from grapes. Squash grapes into a bucket and the juice soon becomes intoxicating. Wherever grapes grow, we've been drinking wine, it seems, since the beginning of time. There's a bit more to it, of course. The gods come into it, so do the enemies of pleasure. Wars are fought, poems are written, mighty claims are made. Among the mightiest, Pliny the Elder's, in vino veritas, in wine is truth. Well, maybe, on a good night. Arriving in our bookshops in October will be A New History of Wine, From the Late Stone Age to 2025, written by the University College of London historian, Kathleen Burke, who joins me now from the UK. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I look forward to chatting with you.
It is so easy, isn't it? You just squash up grapes, leave them for a while, and it turns into alcohol.
Yes, of course, the quality is debatable, yes. But you're right. All you need are grapes.
And you make the point that it hardly needed to be invented. It was just there for people to make something of, and they did.
Well, they did, but of course it was back about 10,000 years ago or so. Some early Neolithic people were stomping through the forest looking to hunt for something. They heard birds. They looked up. They pulled grapes down because if the birds were eating them, they wouldn't be poisonous. Liked them, filled their sacks or whatever, and took them back home and left them there. And in due course, although it started out cold, they could see it was all bubbling and it was warm. And when the bubbling stopped, they either had someone offer or they forced someone to put their finger in it and taste it. Then they, you know, put a ladle in and forced him to drink it. Would he die? No, what he got was intoxicated. You know what you do when you're highly intoxicated. You grab people. You either say you love them or you're going to kill them. And he kept drinking and finally just fell on the floor and woke up the next morning nauseous and ill.
You make the argument that because it seemed like magic, there was this connection to the gods, there was this possibility that this was something to do with gods, a gift of some kind, and it features in so many religions.
Many of us know about the story in the Bible where Noah plants the first vines, makes the wine, gets intoxicated in his tent, and then he's discovered. And of course, the land of Canaan, which includes Israel and Lebanon and part of Syria, was really where it went from that area out to the Mediterranean. But of course, if you think about it, how did it get from Georgia to there? And it went through Turkey, and it was picked up by all sorts of empires, and it got carried to the West. And when we get to the Canaanites, about 12th century BC, it really starts spreading around Eastern Mediterranean and then further out. So that's when wine becomes a part of, in a sense, known history.
Kathleen, all this is happening because people love this stuff. They love drinking it. They love intoxication, and there are all sorts of other domestic uses for it. Is it clear whether or not from the beginning there were also people who hated this stuff, who didn't want people to drink it, who saw it as evil?
Well, not as far as from the beginning. Of course, you have two things here. You have the Islamic world, where it's sort of a mixed story. Theoretically, it is forbidden by Allah. But all during this period of the Islamic era, including the Ottomans, a number of people drank it. A number of people wrote poetry about it. But the part everyone knows about is prohibition in the United States, when theoretically it was forbidden, but there were all sorts of loopholes that were taken advantage of. So although people on the whole really liked it, there were people who thought it was bad and did their best to try to stop it. And no place really has this been successful as far as we know.
You tell us about medical champagne.
Well, yes, in this is prohibition in the States. And one loophole is for medical reasons. And a winemaker in California called Paul Masson, which has been, you know, one of the larger ones, what they did was they made their wine, but they called it medicinal champagne, which is used, they said, for those diseases that require a draft of champagne. And so that was one of the medical reasons, in fact. One of my favorite stories, I must say.
I'm going to drink no other brand for the rest of my life. Kathleen, how serious is the Islamic objection to alcohol? Because, yes, you know, we know all about it, but Omar Khayyam was a poet, a Muslim poet, who wrote some of the greatest poetry celebrating drinking.
Yes, two things. Yes, it is celebrating drinking, but it's also seen as a symbolic way of objecting to the extremely difficult Islamic movement at that time. And my theory is that he wrote this and then they met in private homes. He certainly wasn't the only one doing that. And they drank a glass of wine and read it to each other. But he wasn't, of course, the only poet. There were two others that, in fact, one of them called Abu Dawas was considered by T.S. Eliot one of the great poets. So there were poets. Sometimes they were celebrated. Sometimes they got thrown into jail because they drank too much or were too licentious. But yes, poetry has been part of the life of many areas, in particular China, when the interrelationship of wine and poetry has been incredibly important ever since it was invented, discovered, and even until now. Li Bao, one of the great poets, indeed between in two centuries, the 7th century around there, 50,000 poems were written, and some of them can be people recite today. So almost more than any other country, the interrelationship of wine and poetry dominates in China.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Professor Kathleen Burke about her book, Wine, A Global History. Kathleen, wine in Roman times, they drank a huge amount of it, didn't they? But at what concentration?
When they were made, they were quite strong. And so they were diluted in Greece with, as far as one knows, seawater. In Rome, it's unclear, but I suspect they had moved their way to water without salt. Everyone drank it. They had to drink it. They needed it for health reasons. That is to say, water could kill you. They also drank it for, of course, religious reasons, but also for pleasure. And some of the wine was dire, much of which was drunk by poor people for calories. You only had wine and bread dominating most diets. They were drank by, shall we say, the better sort. In other words, those who had money, but they drank better wine, and they drank it for all sorts of reasons, but mainly for pleasure. They drank it in banquets. They drank it at home. So in Rome, a lot of wine was drunk. And one great thing about Roman wine is it had its Robert Parker of the day. It had Pliny the Elder was probably the first critic who knew a lot about wine. He wrote a whole book, 14, about it, in fact, which told about the vines, told about the areas where they grew well, where they grew badly, how long they lasted. What about foreign wines? They even classified wines into five classifications, which, of course, what the French did in 1855 and still exists. So Roman wine was very important. And in fact, it spread from Rome to Gaul and Germany, where the Romans made awful wine. They adulterated it. They put it in filthy casks because apparently the barbarians like that. And this wine, they did not send back to Rome. They sent it up to various parts of Gaul and, of course, across to Germania, as it were.
The wine they drank, the Greeks and the Romans, was it dry or sweet?
It was madly sweet. It began to be dry in Rome, but in Greece, very sweet wine was the wine that they wanted to drink. They had certain wines from certain areas. The great, says Pramnian wine, came from the island of Lesbos, for example. And the Maronian wine, which Homer used to make the one-eyed Cyclops drunk so he and his men could push a burnt stick into his eye so he couldn't see. That was this Maronian wine. And although the Greeks would dilute it probably 20 to 1, he gave it undiluted to the Cyclops. And it didn't take very long for him to fall on the ground drunk and sleepy. Well, you know, gobbets of human flesh came out of his mouth because he'd been eating the sailors.
Oh, he deserved to be punished. There's no doubt about it, Kathleen. He deserved to be punished.
Homer thought he deserved to be punished. Odysseus, this is from the Odyssey, which we now all know because the new film, they had been captured by the Cyclops. And the one problem there, which leads to most of the rest of the Odyssey, is that his father was Poseidon. He was Neptune. He was the god of the sea. And so he did his best for the next 9 or 10 years to stop Odysseus from actually getting back to Ithaca, back home.
One of the things I found so fascinating in your work is your study of how wine traveled. How did it travel to begin with? And how did the ways in which change came to the packaging of wine that made such a difference to what we drink today?
Well, wine, of course, was stored in casks. What the Romans did, in fact, was they stuffed it with cork. And then that was forgotten over centuries, and it was rediscovered in the modern period. But they sent it in casks, and the problem was you could send four casks if you had a wagon and about 6 to 8 oxen. And this was expensive, and somehow it might go bad. Sometimes those who were taking care of it drank some of it, and it just went off. So what gradually developed was that it went by ship. And the great country there was the Dutch. They had the largest merchant marine in the world. This is really from the 17th and part of the 18th century. And they carried this wine. They carried it as far as England. They carried it around up the Baltic, up to Hamburg. They carried it to the Far East. Remember, they had the Dutch East Indies. And so they carried wine all the way essentially around most of the known world. And so we can owe to the Dutch the actual, not only the transformation of wine, but they also developed new wines. They were the ones who drained Medoc, you know, the great area now for French Bordeaux wines. They drained it. They actually decided they needed more sweet wine. So they developed Sauternes, as in Chateau Yquem. They went up to what, you know, the Loire, which is, you know, as you know, north of Paris, and discovered new areas where they could evade taxes. That was one of the things they were trying to do, was evading taxes. So essentially, the Dutch, most people don't really know about how important they were.
When did wine start to be carried in bottles?
Bottles as such really became important in the 17th and 18th centuries. The bottle, as it began to be known as today, was actually invented by an Englishman. And one thing about that is that it was so strong that you could carry champagne in it. You could carry sparkling wines, which the second fermentation, which is fermentation in bottle, could cause them to explode. The other
dangerous
thing is that, absolutely, in fact, visiting, when champagne became very important in the sort of second half of the 19th century, before they discovered how to stop this, as it were, when you visited Champagne, no matter whether you worked there or were a visitor down to the cellars, you had to wear a mask of tiny chicken wire, I suppose you might say.
Yes.
So that when they exploded as you walked through the cellar, you wouldn't get torn to pieces by these explosions.
Of course.
So it's interesting, you know, for several centuries, indeed from about the 13th century, the English were considered to have the best palates in the world. And the cost, the classification of wine in France is it first growth or second growth, was based on what the English would pay for it. So again, it's sort of forgotten by many people how important England was in that sense in development of some really good wines. And of course, the point about being able to stack these slender bottles in cellars was you got a place, you started having vintage port, because they could be stored. They wouldn't have to be drunk straight away and not very nice. So bottles as such, the ones that could, the strong ones and the useful sized ones, were invented in England.
Alas, we've only got a few minutes to go, but I wondered if you could tell us how you first came to know wine, because you grew up with it.
I grew up with it in California. We had a family farm, and my five brothers and sisters and I had to go out and we picked grapes and tied vines, and I drove tractor. When I went up to Berkeley, I had a boyfriend who had a 750cc motorcycle, and we drove around Napa, and he drove, and I tasted. Sadly or unsadly, I didn't know about spitting it out then. Then at Oxford, I discovered European wines. And from that on, my boyfriend then, now my husband, also liked wine. And we just, by the mid-80s, we had begun our current cellar. By the late 1990s, I wanted to know more about wine. I knew that I liked it, but I didn't know why it was any good. And so I sat the 3 years of the wine exams in London. And after that, I started judging and I started writing. And eventually in 2021, to my utter astonishment and deep pleasure, I was asked to write a global history of wine, which is what I've been doing until earlier this year. So I went from picking the grapes to being able to tell other people or explain to other people how this all developed to now.
Now, if you were going out now today, and I don't mean to spend extravagantly, but what would be the wine you would most like to just be able to go out and buy a bottle of?
Well, two things. For dry wine, wine that isn't fortified, it would be probably a great German wine. I love German wine and Austrian wine.
Some names of great German wine or Austrian wine?
Oh, those made by J.J. Prüm, those made by Huber down in Baden, the warmer part of Germany. Egon Müller, who also makes wine in Yugoslavia. The Mosel is the one lately that is the most desired wine. But the Rheingau area was the one that was incredibly famous and desired for most centuries until the First World War. England loved it. All sorts of wines now come up. Frankenweins, those that you could find in those box bottles, the ones that don't go in bins because they're sort of round with a sticking up top. If I was going to have the wine that lasted, that I really love, it's old Madeira, which lasts. I mean, there have been a bottle of Madeira was discovered, a little while ago, that had been in a cellar for almost 200 years. Now, I'm not sure what it tasted like by that time, but certainly I have some at home that I can open up and have a glass in the evening if I want and cork it back up. And I know that when I come again to it, say a week later, a month later, even a year later, although it usually doesn't last that long, it would be fine. I could enjoy it still. But for wine that I would sit on the Pacific Ocean with my five brothers and sisters and drink, looking out at the ocean, it would either, for light wine, it would probably be a J.J. Prüm wine, or if it was going to be a fortified wine, it would either be a vintage port or an old Madeira.
Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Professor Kathleen Burke, author of Wine, A Global History, which will be in Australian bookshops in October. Kathleen, two things I have to tell you. One is, I drank so much port at university, cheap, horrible port, that I can't touch it now. It's just been ruined for me for life. The other thing is that some years ago now, my father was dying and he had collected wine and he was very Presbyterian soul. And so, there was never a good time to drink the wine that he'd put down, but he was dying. And so he said, well, let's now drink some of that old wine. And it had all gone off. He'd kept it all too long. Drink your wine is the lesson I take from that.
Yes, especially your vintage 2000 Clarets, which I understand you're keen on red wines.
Yes, and, we are.
Well, so am I. It's just we haven't talked today. Yes, if you're ever in England, David, I will take you to my wine club in London, which has 8,000 wines, 400 of which are by the glass, and we will have an utterly wonderful evening.
Kathleen, thank you. I'll take you up on that. I will definitely take you up on that. Yes. I was in England for a few years, and one of the terrible things, you would take people, going to dinner, you would take people a really wonderful Australian wine, and they'd put it aside and serve you some dreadful second-rate French wine. And you'd look across the room at the bottle you'd brought, never opened. Obviously, you can tell I've led a very sad life. And thanks so much for tonight.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And that's the show. On our next, the extraordinary private public inquiry being conducted around the country by Peter Garrett into AUKUS. He and his commissioners can't compel witnesses to testify, but they're lining up for and against the most controversial weapons procurement program in the history of Australia.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.